Couple of reminders in case you need them that the first quiz is on Monday. And let me very quickly review the rules, because even though we've gone over it, I'm sure there's some missing pieces that are still out there. It'll be the first 30 minutes, not in the middle 30 minutes, not in the last 30 minutes, so please don't come late. Okay? Second, if you're going to miss the quiz, what do you need to do? Let me know. Okay? Email me, text me, tweet me. No, actually, just email me. Don't do any of the other stuff. I can't keep track of it. Email me before the quiz. Key is before the quiz. So I'll check at, my last check will be at 10:25 before I come down. So please email me by 10:25. The reason is I don't want to give you the option of taking the quiz and then discovering it wasn't a good quiz and then disappearing yourself. So in a sense, you have to let me know before the quiz. And if you do badly on the quiz, remember, if you do all three quizzes, your worst quiz will get marked up to the average. So you got a freebie. Just don't try to not make it the first one, right? Because then you got the rest of the semester where you don't have a freebie. So give it your best shot. And I will post a webcast after class today, which will be a review session for the quiz. It'll cover everything through growth, which we might actually get past today, but it'll cover discount rates, cash flows, growth, and all the big picture stuff that we did about making sure your cash flows were consistent with your discount rate. Okay, so next Monday, 10:30 to 11, I'm going to try to get a second room. I don't know whether we will need one because it looks, well, if everybody's here, we'll probably have every seat filled. I'll let you know if you're going to have a second room and if you're going to be assigned to that second room. It'll be somewhere in the second. I'm not going to get a second room if it's going to be in some other building or some other floor. So if I can get something in the second floor, I'm going to try. If not, we will, you know, just make the plans for the moment to be here on Monday. Any questions about the quiz? It's open book, open notes, your own book and your own notes, hopefully. Yeah. You can use your iPads as long as you don't have connectivity, so turn off the Wi-Fi on it. Okay? You can't use your laptops because that's a little too much at this moment. I still have to grapple with what to do about it. But the honor code basically is what I'll have to draw on because I have no way of knowing whether you're on Wi-Fi, whether you're messaging people in the room. So hopefully you're not going to be doing that. But there's not much I can do because many of you do have your lecture notes on the iPad, so you have to use it. So that's about those are the only rules. So you know it's going to be, if you want to see every quiz I've ever given in this class, it's there. So you can't complain that you don't know what the quiz will look like. You actually know too much about what the quiz will look like, which might be a danger because you think you've got the whole thing nailed and my job is to try to stay one step ahead of you. So I'm still thinking about how to do that. So I haven't done it yet. So I'm not going to give away anything today because I haven't written the quiz. So sometime between today and Monday, I will write the quiz. I'm sure you'll have extreme sympathy for my plight in writing your quiz, but no. That's going to be essentially, let's put it this way. 85% of what you're going to see on the quiz will look familiar. 15% will look like you've never seen it before, but you actually have. I'm just hiding it behind things that make it look unfamiliar. So as long as you can take the basic stuff and think for yourself, which is kind of tough to do in 30 minutes because you're kind of panicking, you're going to be okay. Okay, so that's it. The TAs are having review sessions. They've been having review sessions every week now for the last 2 weeks. They'll have one tomorrow, I think, from 4:30 to 5:30. There's a Google, the room only fits 40, so if you really have trouble with the basics, okay, try to go to that session as well. Okay, so that's it for the quiz. Let's start with today's topic of the day. We're going to talk about growth rates. We've already talked about historical growth. We're going to talk about analyst estimates of growth, and we're also going to talk about fundamental growth. So let's set the stage for that with a couple of very simple choices. Let's say you're valuing a company where you can get an analyst estimate of growth and earnings for your company. And for many of your companies, especially if it's a large market cap, widely followed company, this is going to be the case. You go to Yahoo Finance or you go to Google Finance, you'd see an expected growth rate for this company. And we talked about what that growth rate was in the last session at the start of the session. So you're going to be sorely tempted to say, hey, you know what? These guys spend all their time with these companies. And they do. They know more about this company than I do, which is true. So let me use their growth rate in my valuation. you kind of know what my suggestion will be, but let's see why this is not a good idea. First, is it because the growth is estimated in earnings per share and the growth rate you're looking for is a growth in revenues or operating income? Second, is it because the growth rate that analysts project is often very highly correlated with past growth? Is it because the analyst estimate of growth is not that good? It doesn't give you a good projection for the future. Is it because if you use an analyst estimate of growth, you're really not valuing the company? You've turned over the most critical input into the valuation of the company. Is it all of the above, some of the above, none of the above? What do you think? Are all those statements fundamentally true? Is it a growth in earnings per share? Yes, it is, in fact. And you're often projecting growth in net income or operating income or revenue. So first, the growth rate doesn't fit. Second, it turns out that the best predictor of analyst estimates of growth is just past growth, especially the long-term growth rate. Okay. Third, one of the things we're going to talk about today is analysts are not that good at forecasting, especially long-term growth. If they have any strength, it's usually in getting the earnings per share in the next quarter right, and after that, the predictive ability drops off dramatically. And fourth, if you're going to do a valuation, you've got to claim ownership of it. Basically, this has to be your valuation. It might be wrong, but at least it's your valuation going wrong. And the only way to claim ownership of a valuation is if you own the growth rate. If you let somebody else tell you the growth rate, an analyst, a manager, it's no longer your valuation. So I think all of those are true, and those are all reasons why you should not use an analyst. That doesn't mean you shouldn't look it up, but you shouldn't use it as your growth rate in your valuation. Next, I'm going to make a big deal about fundamental growth. Sounds fancy, but fundamental growth is based on two premises. One is, to grow, you have to reinvest. So you're going to put money back into the business. And second, how much you grow will be a function of not just how much you reinvest, but how well you reinvest. So we're going to make a big deal about answering those two questions. How much are you reinvesting? How well are you reinvesting? So let's assume you have a company that's reporting after-tax operating income of $75 million on actually invested capital of $1 billion. Cross out the revenues, make it invested capital of $1 billion. So their return on invested capital right now is 7.5%. So they have stable margins, stable return on capital, they're making $75 million. This company does not plan to put any money back into its assets. Doesn't mean it's going to let them run down. It's going to maintain its existing factories and capacity. It's not going to expand them. And that return on capital is going to stay stable over time. So 7.5% is pretty much your return on capital in perpetuity. I'm going to read some statements. So based on what I've told you about the company, which of the following is true? The company cannot grow. The company cannot grow in the short term. The company cannot have sustainable long-term growth, or will the company shrink? No growth. Some growth, maybe in the short term. Okay. No long-term sustainable growth, or will the growth actually be negative? First, when I say they don't reinvest back, I'm not saying they're not going to have capital expenditures, right? What am I saying? That if there's capital expenditures, it's going to go to maintain existing assets, which means that it might be actually roughly equal to depreciation or slightly more, right? So it doesn't mean that they're letting, so they shouldn't shrink because they have the existing capacity. Can they grow in the short term? If the return on capital is fixed, how the heck can they grow? It's 7.5%, it's mathematical, right? So the return on capital stays at 7.5%. If they're not reinvesting, what will happen to the invested capital? It'll stay at $1 billion. So if you're going to continue to earn 7.5% and the invested capital is frozen at $1 billion, you can't have growth in the short term, medium term, or long term. This company will have zero growth in perpetuity. File that away, because this is going to be central to thinking about growth in the long term, growth forever, is to think about return on. So if you have a stable return on capital, the only way you can grow is to do what? You've got to increase your invested capital, right? And the only way you can increase the invested capital is by putting money back into the business in the form of net capital expenditures and working capital. So that's what reinvestment does. It's a change in invested capital year to year. And if there's no change and your return on capital stays fixed, there can be no growth. Finally, let's say I took the same company that I just described in the previous page, and I told you that next year, just 1 year, they're going to cut costs and improve their efficiency. They're going to become much more efficient about the way they're investing. And they're going to increase their return on capital to 10% next year. They're not reinvesting any money. They're just improving the efficiency. What's the growth rate going to be next year? Look at the math. Right now, what's their invested capital? A billion. What are they making as after-tax operating income? $75 million. Next year, they're going to have the same invested capital because they're not reinvesting anybody, but they're going to make 10% of that invested capital, which means they're going to make $1 billion. Their growth rate next year is going to be 33.33%. What's it going to be the year after? It's going to go back to zero. Efficiency can generate short-term growth. And so we're going to talk about what kinds of companies this is a kind of a bonus, right? Because without reinvesting money, you're getting growth because you're making your assets more efficient. I'm going to reward you by giving you a growth rate for the periods where you can improve your return on capital, but it's finite. It's finite because I can't keep going back to that well to make myself more efficient, because once I hit a certain point, that's it. So today we're going to talk about fundamental growth. We're going to talk about sustainable long-term growth, but we're also going to talk about efficiency growth and how that can sometimes help you in companies in terms of pushing up the growth, at least for the near term. So let's go back to where I left you on Monday. And go to page. I think we were on page 148. So we talked about historical growth last session, right? And we talked about all the little mechanical questions you got to deal with. What to do about negative earnings, what to do about the fact that companies get bigger. But I'll give you the most depressing aspect of historical growth. When people look at historical growth and they use it to forecast the future, they're assuming that the past is a good reflection of the future, right? And people have taken this for granted for a long time. A lot of modeling is based on looking at what was the growth rate over the last 5 years. So about 50 years ago almost, it's a very old study, a guy called I.M.D. Little, that was his name, came to do a PhD. He was British. He came here to do a PhD, and he picked as his thesis this question, which is, if you know the growth rate over the last 5 years, how much does it help you in forecasting the growth rate over the next five? And in those days, you had to hand collect the data, so he kind of kept it simple. So here's what he did. He took U.S. companies, and he took their growth rates from 1951 to 55. And he took the growth rates for the same companies from 56 to 60. It's a very simple study. So what's he trying to check? If I know the growth rate from 51 to 55, how much does it help me to predict the growth rate from 56 to 60? So statistically, how do you test that? What are you checking for? You're checking for how high is the correlation between the two numbers, right? I'll save you the trouble of what he found, because I'll tell you the title of his dissertation thesis. He called it Higgledy-Piggledy Growth. Leave it to the British to come up with a really interesting name for a thesis, right? Higgledy-Piggledy Growth. So what do you think he found? First, if you wanted to use historical growth, what would you like to see? A nice big positive correlation or a nice big negative correlation? Nice big positive correlation would mean that if you have high growth, in fact, you can live with both, right? If you're a forecaster, high negative correlation or high positive, both, it's like having a really great forecaster or a really horrible forecaster. You know, remember a horrible forecaster? One who gets it wrong every single time. They're both worth money. You just have to act differently. If you have a really great forecaster, you listen to what he tells you and you do exactly what he tells you to do. If you have a really horrible forecaster, you listen to what he tells you and you do the exact opposite. Either way, you come out a winner. What's your worst case scenario? Is the correlation is close to zero. That's exactly what he found. That is a scary thought, because think of how often you invest based on past growth. In fact, when we think about growth, we almost always think about past growth, right? When people try to sell you companies, say, look how quickly it's grown in the last 5 years. And then we make these extrapolations and we pay these high price earnings ratios. And this study finds that past growth is a terrible predictor of future growth. So here's what I do with past growth. I estimate it. I dance around it. Then I let it go. I'm not going to ignore it completely, but it's not going to become my growth rate for the future. And thank God for that. You know what, thank God for that? If the best predictor of future growth was past growth, I really don't need people to value companies, right? You could set a computer on autopilot and you could just value every company. Think of how much cheaper and more unbiased that valuation would be. So be glad for small blessings. Past growth is not particularly useful. So let's turn to the second avenue, which is looking at what other people are forecasting as growth. And let's in particular focus on sell-side equity research analysts. I think in the first or second session, I drew the contrast, right? Sell-side equity research analysts are the analysts who work at investment banks. They're called sell-side because the bulk of their job is selling, which is they do equity research and they sell it to, sell it not in the conventional sense for money, but sell it in the sense of ideas. You want portfolio managers to use your research and then use your investment bank as their avenue for trading, all these. So it's kind of a strange business. But sell-side equity research analysts are the ones you read about in the Wall Street Journal. They're the ones whose names are up there. Buy-side equity research analysts, on the other hand, toil in anonymous settings. I don't mean to sound like they're slaves working somewhere, but they're, you know, working in Boston for Fidelity. You don't ever read their names because the research they do goes just to their portfolio managers. So when you see a growth rate from analysts for your company, it's almost always going to be sell-side growth, because they're the ones who throw out their reports, and those are the ones we see. So it is, if any sell-side equity research analyst in a previous lifetime in here? You don't even want to admit to it anymore? Okay. But if you've ever worked around sell-side analysts, they're obsessed with not just earnings per share, but earnings per share next quarter. An astonishing amount of their time is spent focusing on earnings per share next quarter and the growth in earnings. So let's take that as a granted. These are analysts. There are dozens and dozens. In fact, there are companies like Apple which have 60 analysts tracking them. And that's all they do is they track Apple. They make forecasts of earnings and earnings growth. And you would think that because so much time and resources get spent on it, and they have access, let's face it, to a lot more information, partly because they have more time to work on this, that their estimates of growth should be much better than the estimates of growth you and I will come up with, even with all our homework. Let's start off with that proposition, though. Is that true? Are analysts' estimates of growth that much better than the estimates of growth we could come up with? So there have been studies that have been done of this over the last 35 years, and here's what they do. They take the forecasted earnings per share next quarter, which is where the analyst advantage should be greatest, and they compare the analyst forecast with just using a time series model. What does a time series model use as data? Time series models don't stop and ask the managers, what do you think? They look at the past, they just forecast. So it's almost like a blind test against historical growth. Analysts should beat historical growth, right? Because think about it. The historical growth just uses the numbers through last quarter. Analysts have had access to all the other stuff, the news on the company. So even if they don't talk to managers, you'd think that their forecasts were much better. And I'll give you the good news first and the bad news later. The good news is analyst forecasts are better than history. So the way to think about forecast, the quality of forecast is look at your forecast error. What is that? That's a difference between your forecasted earnings and the actual earnings. So if you're a perfect forecaster, that number should be what? Zero, right? So the closer you get to zero, the more perfect you are. Analysts are not perfect, but the analyst error on forecast is consistently lower than the error you would have got if you'd just taken a time series model and forecasted earnings next quarter. That's the good news. You see what the bad news is? How many hundreds of millions of dollars do we spend on equity research? And what's the payoff we get? A 2.3%, 2.5% saving in standard error? That's surprisingly small, right? You'd think the savings would be much larger. But studies that look at analyst forecasts find that there isn't that much value added, even if you focus just on earnings per share next quarter. If you go past that to earnings per share in the next four quarters, next 2 years, next 5 years, the advantage dissipates completely. So analyst forecasts, especially if you think about long-term earnings, really are no better than using historical growth, and that's higgledy-piggledy to begin with, right? Now, I actually did present these results to analysts sometimes, and they don't like me for doing it. So you collect these sell-side equity research, and I said, what's wrong with you guys? And you know what they always do? They blame the guy outside. They said, it's not us. We're the good analysts. There are the bad guys pulling the average. No. You should be focusing on the best of us. I said, okay. In fact, among the analyst community, there is this special sub-community of the best of the analysts, right? What are they called? They're called the Institutional Investor All-America Analysts. It's like a football team, like an all-pro team, right? So basically, these are your All-America Analysts. They must be special. And in fact, there are studies that look at All-America Analysts to see if, in fact, if you're an equity research analyst, you become an All-America Analyst, you have it made. In most investment banks, you get a bonus when you become an All-America Analyst, and then it becomes part of your name for the rest of your life. So when you call somebody, say, Joe Brown, All-America Analyst, it's almost like the CFA, people say, some people who introduce themselves and at the end of the name say CFA, MBA, you know, so basically, look how many degrees I have. So All-America Analyst becomes an appendage, and you're going to see in a minute why people do it. So this study actually looked at All-America Analysts and asked a very simple question. How do you get to be an all? You must be a superior forecaster, right? So, in fact, when they looked at the year before these guys were chosen as an All-America Analyst, there was actually no evidence that they were better at forecasting. In fact, they were a little worse at forecasting earnings than the typical analysts. That's strange, right? How did they become All-America Analysts if they're not that good at forecasting? All-America Analysts are picked based on a poll. So how do people recognize your name in a poll? Because you've read your name in the Wall Street Journal. Does it matter what you said? No, you can say incredibly stupid things. They don't remember what you said. I said, I remember that guy. He's on the news all the time. You forget to mention the fact that he says incredibly stupid things every time he's in the news. But if you're quotable, and to be quotable, all you have to do is say outrageous things sometimes. You're going to be... This is not a measure of how good you are. It's a popularity poll based on how much your media profile is. I'll wager that if you were able to measure media profiles, if you're an analyst at Goldman Sachs, you start off with a significant advantage over an analyst at a smaller place. And if you have an analyst who has the private phone numbers of three Wall Street journalists, your profile goes up even higher. There have been cases of analysts actually getting out there and campaigning to be on the poll. Okay, so trying to get their profile up, saying, you've never heard of me, but I'm the most special analyst in here. I want to let you know. No. But here's something magical that happens. The year after they become All-America analysts, remember they were a little worse than the average analyst the year before. The year after, they magically become a little better than the average analyst. This shows you how self-esteem is so critical to forecasting, right? So basically, now what do you think happens? How do you magically go from being a below-average forecaster to an above-average forecaster? Justin?
Because of their high profile, they probably have better access to management.
Remember I said from this point on, you pick up the phone, you can say, Joe Brown, All-America Analyst. It's amazing how people who would never talk to you before, people in the company, you know. Of course, there are all these SEC rules that you have to follow. You know. But even within those parameters, your access to information magically starts to improve. People think you have a profile to get it out there. You have the megaphone. But they're not magically that much better, but there is an improvement. It is true that when you revise earnings and you're an All-America analyst, you have a much bigger impact on prices. And you can see why again, right? You're an All-America analyst, you revise earnings, the Wall Street Journal picks it up and says, All-America analyst Joe Brown has lowered earnings for Apple, everybody reacts. And if you make recommendations, you do affect prices a little more than the typical analyst does. I've actually, basically it's like being a boxer and I've just raised you in the weight class from lightweight to middleweight or heavyweight, depending upon how many All-America crowns I've given you. But here's an interesting asymmetry, and this is true across all recommendations. When All-America analysts put out buy recommendations, the stock price goes up on average about 3%. On sell recommendations, it goes down about 5%. So there's a little asymmetry. Sell recommendations have a bigger oomph to them than buy recommendations do. And there's a simple explanation for that, right? Which is more common, buy or sell recommendations? It's 6-1 still. It used to be 15-1 a decade ago. It's now 6-1. For every sell recommendation, there are 6 buys. But here's an interesting follow-up. When you track these recommendations through, in the 6 months following, the buy recommendations actually lose some of that oomph. The 3% becomes a 2.4%, so you've lost 0.6%. The sell recommendations actually continue to do what you expect them to. So what does that tell you? That in terms of information, a sell recommendation actually contains a lot more information than a buy recommendation does. It has a lot longer impact, and the impact tends to be much larger. If you're reading an equity research report and reading a sell, maybe you should react a little sooner and do something more than when you read a buy, because it's so unusual to actually get a sell. And I talked about the flaking mechanism that you see in equity research, which is people hate to use the word sell. So what do? They say, we've just lowered you from a strong buy to a semi-strong buy, let's stop playing this game. Just say buy, sell. Let's cut to the recommendation. But there's a reason for that, right? Why do analysts hate to use the word sell? Because then you're on the blacklist for the company, right? And then you're on the blacklist, that affects your access to the company. So when they call the nice equity research conference, everybody else is in that Sundance five-star resort, and they put you up at the Days Inn 50 miles away. So it's tough. We couldn't find rooms for you. You call, and magically everybody's hanging up on you. And if you do this on a company that Donald Trump runs, he sues you. In fact, he sued equity research analysts for putting sell recommendations. The guy he never ceases to amaze me, the depths that he can go to in terms of... In fact, there was one case where he sued and the brokerage house actually fired the analyst. That's a complete lack of... I mean, if I were an investor using that brokerage house, I'd be running out of there as quickly as I could. So if the argument is, hey, the best analysts do better, there is no evidence. So let's think about why this is. Why doesn't sell-side equity research deliver more oomph to it, given all the time? These are bright people. Most of the analysts I talk to, I say, hey, these guys know their business really well. They should be better than what they actually are. So here are five things that strike me as why sell-side equity research is in trouble. And it is in trouble. We can dance around this. It is in deep trouble around the globe. So here are the five things that strike me as what's wrong. The first is tunnel vision. If you go to work in sell-side equity research, first you're given a sector. Then you're given 15 companies in the sector. And you're told for the rest of your life, forget the rest of the world exists, right? It's a dangerous place to put you, but that's exactly what you're asked to do. Your job is to do cable companies. So you're sitting there doing cable companies until you go crazy. You're forgetting that the rest of the world is shifting around. You have Hulu and Netflix. They're not in your span of reference. It's easy to miss big picture changes because you have tunnel vision. Second, and as I go through these, think about if you were redesigning sell-side equity research, what you would do differently, right? So the first problem is tunnel vision. The second is what I call a disease, which is this lemmingitis, which is one equity research analyst revises earnings upwards for a company. Watch for the next 3 or 4 days, and you will see 15 other analysts all update their earnings as well. One cuts earnings, everybody else kind of. Why? Because you don't want to be the last person in line. A lot of lemmingitis. So you put together tunnel vision and lemmingitis, you can see what's coming, right? The third is, you've heard of the Stockholm syndrome? This is when people get kidnapped or held hostage, and after a while they start identifying with the hostage takers. The whole idea of equity research is you're supposed to be an outsider looking at companies and trying to be objective about, are these companies well-run? But these equity research analysts, because of the fact that they have this tunnel vision, work with these same 15, if you've been an equity research analyst for 20 years, I guarantee you know these CEOs really well. You play golf with them, you hang out with them, you really like these people. And you see why the Stockholm syndrome then kicks in? You think your job is to defend the company in the marketplace rather than assess what the company should be worth? After I called Yahoo part of the Walking Dead, got a couple of very angry emails from equity research analysts following Yahoo. So how dare you pick on Yahoo like this? I'll pick on Yahoo if I feel like it, but also... If you're the sell-side equity research analyst tracking Yahoo, what is it, why is it your job? Somebody, if Marissa Meyer had emailed me saying, how dare you ask me to fire everybody but myself? Because at the end of the post, if you read, I said, suggested that Yahoo go down to a staff of one. But I let them splurge. I said, you can get a dual display terminal. And on one, you can watch Alibaba. The other way, you can watch Yahoo Japan. And every day you come in, you watch both, and you go home. And if she'd email me saying, that's a terrible idea, how dare you, know, that's different. But you're an equity research analyst. Why are you getting so hard under the collar? Because I don't think your company has anywhere to go. The fourth is what I call factophobia. You read equity research analysts, it's like sometimes like reading Charles Dickens. There's a story, and there's a story on top of a story, and there's a story on top of that story. And after a while, you say, what am I reading about? No. So you read an equity research report about Alibaba, you're reading about China, its history, and the Great Wall. Said, no, this has nothing to do with Alibaba. They can't get on top of the Great Wall and sell more stuff. But there's again this sense of, let me just tell the story. I've actually heard portfolio managers say, the best thing I get out of sell-side equity research analysts is I get an industry story. Good. I hope you make a lot of money with that story. And finally, and this used to be a little bit more of a problem in the U.S. than it is now, but it's still a problem, which is you have this Jekyll Hyde problem, which is you're the equity research analyst, but you wear another hat. Jack Grugman, 20 years ago, opened the door to this because he was a Solomon telecom analyst, All-America analyst every single year, who essentially bragged about the fact, and this was in the Wall Street Journal. I remember reading the article in the early 90s, bragged about the fact that he brought hundreds of millions of dollars of investment banking business to Solomon. How do you wear those two hats? How do you do equity research in AT&T and also get them to use your investment banking services? The answer is you cannot. And that, of course, led to some issues in the early part of the last decade. And Elliot Abrams made his name by suing equity research analysts. Then he lost his name by doing something stupid, but that's, no. Was it Elliot? No, what was his name? The guy was the New York governor. Spitzer, Elliot Spitzer made it. So but in the U.S. at least, there is this Chinese wall, and I won't tell you how many holes there are in that wall, between equity research and everybody else. And outside the U.S., that pretension is not even maintained. Right, and equity research analysts often do all lots of different roles in this process. But here are my basic propositions about analyst growth. It's nice to know what people are estimating, or analysts are estimating as growth, but there's a lot less information there than you think. You think that they're talking to managers, they're getting some inside information, that's growth. In the U.S., first, that's illegal. So if they're doing it, they're going to jail sooner or later. Second, even if they are talking to managers, what kind of information are they getting? Not unbiased information. They're getting either, information that is biased or information that's too diffuse to actually use. It's a lot less private information, and that private information will tend to be coming from the company. And that's the whole point of all these guidance things, is to get analysts to kind of think alike. There's a high correlation across analysts. That's why All-America analysts do much better than everybody else. So I'm going to close with this proposition. When I value a company, I look at the analyst estimate of growth, but I usually do it after I've estimated my own growth. Because if you look it up before, it's going to be in the back of your head saying, you're using only 6%, everybody else is using 25%. Try not to look at that growth rate till you've made your own reasoned judgment. And if it's very different, don't just automatically change your growth rate. Ask yourself, what might I be missing? Because you might be missing something big that analysts are catching on. Look at the news stories. Maybe there's something big you're missing. But most of the time, it's because you're doing it's two different games. Any questions about analyst growth? Now let's talk about fundamental growth. I'm going to set it up very simply with a company that has $1 billion in invested capital in existing projects, and it's making a 12% return on those projects. So right now, the income you're making as a company is $120 million. I'm going to assume that next year, you add another $100 million in new projects, and that you continue to make 12% on those projects. Just work out the math. The income next year is going to be $132 million. If you ask me to specify the change in earnings, 132 minus 120, that's just coming from the fact that I'm taking new projects, right? And if I were to write it algebraically, here's how I'm going to come up with my growth rate. I'm going to take the 100 million I invested as a percentage of the total earnings, 120, which is 83.33%, multiplied by 12% gives me a growth rate. So when somebody asks you, can you derive the fundamental growth equation for me? It's very simple. Keep the return on capital fixed. Keep the invested capital fixed. The only way you can grow is for the invested capital to grow. And that investment capital growth is coming from the reinvestment. So that's the easy case. If I now told you that this company can go out and take better investments or improve the investments on its existing assets from 12 to 13%, you get a bonus. What's that bonus? By improving the return on capital from 12 to 13% of the existing projects, you get that growth, at least for that year, which is going to be much higher than your fundamental growth rate. So your fundamental growth rate, the long-term growth rate, is always a function of your reinvestment rate and the return on capital. But in the short term, you can get this efficiency oof from improving the efficiency from your existing assets. Okay. So let's set this process up. To estimate fundamental growth then, I need to answer two questions. One is, how much am I reinvesting back into the business? The other is, how well am I reinvesting? The way I measure those will vary depending on whether I'm looking at earnings per share growth, net income growth, or operating income growth. Let me explain. If I'm looking at earnings per share growth, here's how I'm going to measure what my reinvestment is. I'm going to look at the retention ratio. Remember what the retention ratio is? It's a percentage that I don't pay out. So if my payout ratio is 40%, my retention ratio is 60%. And I'm going to measure how well I reinvest with the return on equity. So retention ratio times return on equity will give you my expected growth in earnings per share. So that's with earnings per share numbers. Let me move one step further. Let's suppose I want to get growth in non-cash net income. You know what I mean by non-cash net income? When you look at the total net income for a company, some of it comes from cash and some of it comes from their operating assets. I'm going to set the cash aside. Why mess up my growth rate with something that really is not an operating asset? To measure my growth in non-cash net income, I'm going to look at what percentage of my net income I reinvest back into the business. Notice how it changed from a retention ratio to an actual measurement of what you're reinvesting. And I'm going to measure how much you reinvest with equity by taking net capex plus change in non-cash working capital. That's a reinvestment we've already talked about. But if some of that is funded with debt, remember I as an equity investor don't have to come up with it. So the equity reinvestment rate is how much of the net income I'm putting back into the business to grow. And I'm going to multiply that by the non-cash return on equity. Again, it sounds mysterious, but traditional return on equity is just net income divided by book equity, right? The problem with that, though, if you're a company like Apple, in your book equity, you have $160 billion, which is making what right now? Close to nothing. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take the cash out of the denominator, look at just the non-cash book equity, and I'm going to take the cash income out of the numerator. And if I do that, I have a non-cash return on equity. Equity reinvestment rate times non-cash return equity is expected growth in non-cash net income. So we've gone from earnings per share to net income. Compare those. You can see what I'm trying to do. It's pretty much the same thing. How I measure it varies. If I get to operating income, here's how the numbers are going to change. To measure reinvestment, I'm going to look at how much you reinvest, net capex plus change in working capital, but I'm going to divide it by the after-tax operating income now instead of the net income. And instead of looking at return on equity, which is what equity investors care about, I look at return I make on my overall capital, return on invested capital. These are not three equations. There's three variants on the same equation, right? I'm just measuring those differently. So what I'm going to actually do is take each of those and talk about some of the implications that come out of it, because there's some very interesting things that just come out of it that you might be able to use in thinking about value. Let's start with earnings per share growth. Your reinvestment rate there is your retention ratio. It's whatever you don't pay out as dividends. So what's the highest that number can be? It's the highest your retention ratio can be. 100%. You can't get above 100%, right? You can't retain more than 100% of your earnings. So first, you're already capping that retention ratio at 100%. And you multiply by the return equity. Which effectively means if you buy into this equation, what is the cap on the growth in your earnings per share? What can it not exceed? The retention ratio can't be greater than 1. Then the most your growth in the long term can be in your earnings per share is your return equity. See how powerful this is as an equation. Look up the growth in earnings per share for a company. Look at its return on equity. The analyst is projecting a 35% growth rate in earnings per share, and you have a 12% growth, 12% return on equity. You got to ask, what's going to change here? So this is my first stop. I know it's a very narrow view of the world because I'm focusing on per share numbers, but essentially it's a very, it's a good place to start thinking about growth in earnings is with that earnings per share number. So let's try this. Let's assume I came to you with Wells Fargo in 2008. When in 2008? It matters, right? Because June was it. So let's say this was before the crisis. You look up numbers. You come up with a return on equity based on projected 2008 earnings, and you say it's going to be 17.56%. You look up return on equity by taking, return on equity was 17.56%. So that's based on net income and book value of equity. You look at the retention ratio, and based on their earnings and dividends in 2008, that's about 45.37%. Let's pause right there. If I told you that these were your steady state numbers, you know what I mean by steady state, that they can maintain both the return on equity and the retention ratio, my expected growth rate for Wells Fargo would be roughly 8%. It's a product of those two numbers. That was in June of 2008, right? Let's even make it August of 2008. A month later, you take another look at Wells Fargo. It's been a pretty eventful month, right? The crisis has kicked in. Banks are in big trouble. You're hearing talk about regulatory capital changes. Let's assume that your net income is still what it was last month. They haven't done any updates. It's still the same numbers. Do you see what might change now that we're talking about regulatory? When you think about banks having to increase the regulatory capital, what are you talking about? Increasing the book equity in these banks to reflect the fact that people are worried. So if I came back to you a month later, even if none of the numbers in the bank have changed, here's what I want you to think about. Let's assume that your estimate is, given the crisis, that the regulatory capital requirements will go up by 30%. And let's assume the regulatory capital and book equity are pretty close to each other, which is not a bad assumption for banks. What I want you to think about is what the new return on equity will be. So keep the net income, keep all the numbers for the bank fixed, and tell me what's going to change. So what was it before this happened? For every $100 of book equity, what did you have as net income? You had $17.56, right? If you buy into this assumption of book equity jumping by 30%, what's going to happen? Your net income stays at 17.56. But your denominator is going to go from 100 to 130, which gives you a return on equity. Somebody with a calculator can help me out here. What's 17.56 divided by 130? What is it? 13.5%, right? Do I have confirmation? 13.5? That's right. What's going to happen to my growth rate holding all its constant? Even if I keep the retention ratio the same, at 45.37%, 13.5% times 45% means my expected growth rate is now going to be, it's gone from 8% down to 6%. Now do you see why, if you're investing in banks, regulatory capital is going to be front and center? Increase in regulatory capital, not just about the bank having to raise more money now and diluting shares, it affects your future return equity, and through the return equity, it will affect the expected growth rate. So that's earnings per share, and you can already see how this plays out. So what's the secret to high growth in earnings per share? You want a high return on equity, right? So how do you end up with a high return on equity? I would say there are two ways you can do it. One is you can take really great projects. The other is you can take really average projects and do what? Pump up the return equity by using debt. And why is it helping you? Because the after-tax cost of debt, if it's lower than what you're making on the projects, acts as a kind of leverage effect. In fact, you can break down a return on equity for a company. You can decompose it into two parts. The first is the return on capital. This is what your return on equity would have been if you'd used no debt, plus a leverage effect. And the leverage effect is going to depend on, first, how much you borrow, measured with a debt-to-equity ratio. And the benefits of leverage are going to be captured by the difference between your return on capital and your after-tax cost of debt. So for every dollar that you borrow, if your return capital exceeds the after-tax cost of debt, the return equity will go up. The reason I'm using book values here, it's return equity is a book value measure. So the reason I'm staying with book, usually we use market debt and equity, but here I'm using book debt to equity because, you know, return equity is net income divided by book equity. You think, so what? When you look at a company and you see its return equity is 30%, before you start to get excited, you need to check to see whether it's 30% because they took really good projects, or whether it's 30% because they pumped up their leverage, right? And it's making a difference because the valuation implications are different. If your return equity is 30% because you took really good projects, your value is always going to be higher. But if you got to a 30% return equity because you used 80% debt and 20% equity, your growth might be high, your return equity might be high, but remember your cost of equity is also going to be high. There's a very different impact you have on valuation. So let me give you a couple of companies to kind of illustrate this. This is a very old example. In fact, it's so old that the name of this company has long since changed. Latin America's largest beverage company is a company called Ambev. And this was in 1998 when they were called Brahma. And I was trying to value Brahma. It was on my very first trip to Brazil. It's the very first Brazilian company I'd ever valued. And when I looked at the return equity, I was impressed. It was 31%, so I wanted to see where that return equity came from. I looked at the return on capital, and it was a very good number. It was 19.91%. But it was only 19.91%. But here's why the return equity was so high. Their debt-to-equity ratio was 0.77. So for every dollar of book equity, they had 77 cents in book debt. And the benefits they were getting from debt were immense. 19.91% minus an after-tax cost of debt of 5.61%, which means every dollar of debt they take brings in 14.3 cents in benefits to the equity investor. So here the return on equity was pumped up because the company used leverage. Because all too often when you see companies being sold on the benefits of leverage, one of the things that bankers like to use is earnings per share forecast. They'll show you how much better your earnings per share are going to be if you use debt. And it's almost a given. For most companies, leverage will push up your return equity. It'll push up your growth in earnings per share, but it might not push up your value because it's going to be offset by a partial risk effect. But in some cases, you can look at the companies that don't even borrow money. It's not going to help you. And I'll give you an example. And I go back home, I tend to go for like 4 days because it's been a long time. I really have nobody there to kind of, so basically, and after about 4 days, I'm sick of my family, they're sick of me. So we kind of leave and say, I'll see you next year. But somehow wind that I'm coming home gets out there, and about 6 weeks before I go home, I start getting emails saying, while you're, you know, I'm from south of India, a city called Chennai. While you're in Chennai, could you just come into our company and talk about valuation? And usually my response is, I have only 4 days. But some of these people are people that I knew when I was 2 years old, 3 years old, 4 years old, so I can't easily say no. And this actually was a company where the chairman of the board of directors was my uncle. You can't say, no, I can't do this, I'm too busy. So he said, can you come in and talk to us? And I said, what do you want me to talk about? He said, no, we started using debt about a decade ago because we were told that it'll pump up our return on equity, but we keep pumping up debt and bad things seem to be happening. So I said, I'll take a look and tell you what might be going on. So this is a long time ago, a company called Titan Watches, which is actually a well-regarded watch company. It's a Tata sub-company. And I started grinding through the numbers. So I ground through the numbers. I came up with a 9.5% return on capital, which sounds impressive, but it was a rupee return on capital. The period inflation in India was much, much higher. So I said, okay, return on capital is 9.5%. Then I looked at their cost of debt. And even after taxes, it was 10.13%. I looked at their debt-to-equity ratio, and my uncle was right. They'd been pumping up the debt-to-equity ratio like there was no tomorrow. Was at 191%. So I put it all together. My presentation, I think, lasted 1 minute. I said, here's the problem. You have 9.54%. Here's the effective leverage. You take $1.91 of debt for every dollar of equity. You're making 9.5% and paying out 10.125%. Mathematically, you're in trouble. They said, what should we do? Go ahead. For the moment, I said, you got to get that debt off the books, but a more valuable long-term change would be is if they can bring their return on capital up. Because if it goes to 19%, then leverage will help you. So don't assume that debt is always going to help you. It depends on the company, right? So if you're a company with terrible return on capital, borrowing money will just make the hole deeper. It's not going to get you out of the hole. So leverage is not a magic bullet. You need that return on capital to be high enough to get the benefits of debt. And even then, it's not sufficient to create value because you also have that risk effect to counter. So that's the first stop. That's earnings per share. Let's talk about expected growth in non-cash net income. One of the things I'm going to talk about as we start valuing companies is almost never value companies on a per share basis anymore. The reason is you have other claims on equity. If you have options outstanding, it's very difficult to do things sensibly on a per share basis. I actually think you're much better off valuing companies on an aggregate basis and doing the per share at the very end. So here I want to talk about growth in net income, non-cash net income. And to do this, remember I said I need an equity reinvestment rate and a non-cash return equity. Very simply, the equations are right there, net capex plus change, net of debt divided by net income. And for the non-cash return equity, I'm going to subtract out the interest income from cash from the net income and divide by book value of equity minus cash. Now, if you set these two equations next to each other, the earnings per share equation and this equation, let's focus on that reinvestment number. What did I say the retention ratio could not exceed? 100%. What's the lowest number a retention ratio can be? 0%. So retention ratios are bounded at 0 and 100%. So the first thing that's going to change when you go to this approach is when you compute an equity reinvestment rate, that number can be much higher than 100%, right? If you're reinvesting huge amounts. You see, where am I coming up with the extra money? If your equity reinvestment rate is way above 100%, what are you already telling me? You're raising fresh equity. That, on a per share basis, that wouldn't help you. But if you're looking at the overall company, you can get really high growth in net income for the company if the company keeps issuing shares. And it might not even do it explicitly. What am I talking about? What's a secretive way of issuing shares that kind of is under the radar that you don't notice? Company grows. When it does acquisitions and pays with shares, it's growing, its net income is going to grow, but what's happening under the radar is you're issuing shares. So an equity reinvestment rate is not bounded to be less than 100%. It can be 200, 500, 800%. And it's not bounded at the bottom to be 0%. Can an equity reinvestment rate be negative? Hey, remember we talked about net capex being negative, change in working capital being negative? If you have a negative equity reinvestment rate, it's not the end of the world. It just means that you're shrinking your invested capital. And if everything else stays constant, the growth rate you're going to get out of that is going to be a negative growth rate. A company's getting smaller over time. Okay. So let's look at trying this on Coca-Cola. So in 2010, it had net income of $11.8 billion, book equity of $25.35 billion. So I pull those right off the balance sheet. Usually when I do return equity, and this is, I think, a convention I will stick with, is when I do return equity or return invested capital, I take the net income this year and divide by the book value of equity or capital the previous year, arguing that if you invested a lot towards the end of this year, I can't expect you to make money on it. So I'm giving you a one-year lag because I'm using a 1 year, my discounted cash flow valuation has this artificial one-year window anyway. So book value of equity at the end of 2009 was 25.34. Coca-Cola had a cash balance of $7 billion at the end of 2009. Why am I giving you that? Because out of the book equity, $7 billion is cash, $18 billion is operating assets. I need you to know that to be able to compute the return equity. It had capital expenditures of $2.2 billion, depreciation of $1.44 billion, and a working capital. None of this is difficult to find, right? It's right there in the statement of cash flows. I'm pulling the numbers out. Its total debt increased by $150 million during 2010. That's also in the statement of cash flows. So here's the first thing I did. I computed the reinvestment that Coca-Cola had. Take the capex minus the depreciation plus the change in working capital minus the debt increase. They reinvested $957 million back into the business. Their non-cash net income that year was $11.7 billion. So I subtracted out the interest income from cash. Incidentally, if you cannot find this item for your company, here's all I do. I take the cash balance last year, and if you can't find the interest from cash income, how can you estimate? Just take the T-bill rate during the year, multiply it by the cash balance. It's a very rough way of getting the cash. But that's my estimate of the income. I subtract that out, come up with $11.7 billion. My non-cash book equity is the 25,346 minus the cash. I'm all set to go. Divide the 957 by 11. They barely reinvested any money. Does that surprise you? What does Coca-Cola invest in? What do most beverage companies have to invest in? What's the big investments, physical investments? Usually bottling plants. What did Coca-Cola do 30 years ago that relieved them of that responsibility? They spun off the bottling company. So what do they invest in? The damn syrup. What do they do? Look, it's so kind of, let's face it, there's nothing there. Their biggest investment is probably being treated as an operating expense. And what am I talking about? Advertising, right? So in a sense, it doesn't surprise me that because it didn't capitalize reinvestment, so the reinvestment rate is tiny. But here's the compensating factor. That same force that makes my reinvestment low, the fact that I'm ignoring their brand name advertising, also makes a return on equity really high because the book equity is small as well. That return equity is 64%, non-cash return equity. And you're going to see this for many companies. When you start netting cash out, their returns on equity, if their companies invest in intangible assets, are going to be stratospheric. You multiply the 8.18 by the 63.87%, the growth rate I get for Coca-Cola in their non-cash net income is 5.22%, which actually is not unreasonable given the size of the company and the fact that it's such a large beverage company. So for non-cash net income, I move from retention ratios to equity reinvestment rates, from return on equity to non-cash return on equity. Please don't think of these as separate equations. I know you'd like to do these cheat sheets because it makes you feel in control. Here's the rule, though. If you have 8 pages of cheat sheets, it's really not a cheat sheet anymore. It's open book, open notes. Who are you cheating? Right? You know, so I would actually write the one equation on top and write the variance below, right? Because in a sense, it's the same equation. I'm just re-specifying what retention and or reinvestment and the return on investment are. Which brings me to my third scenario. Let's say I need a growth rate and operating income. Now I have to focus on my reinvestment rate and my return on capital. The reinvestment rate is net capex plus change in working capital divided by after-tax operating income. That same after-tax operating income that you started with your free cash flow to the firm with is now your denominator. As with the equity reinvestment rate, this number can be greater than 100%. It can be less than 0%, so it's not constrained. The return on capital is the after-tax operating income. Same EBIT times 1 minus T. But now it's divided by book value of debt plus book value of equity minus cash. Notice that in all these calculations, this is the only place in finance where book value becomes front and center. You know why we do that? Because we're trying to measure how much you've actually invested in your projects and what they're delivering. So why can't you use market value? If I get my market value right, you know what my return on invested capital should be? What's the definition of market value? You're earning your cost of capital, right? So if I replace book value with market value, every company would be earning its cost of capital. That's kind of pointless. I want to see what you put into a project and what you're getting out of it. What's the weakness? I'm completely and totally dependent on accountants here. My numerator is an accounting number. My denominator is an accounting number. And it freaks the heck out of me. When we come back later and talk about, you know, getting this number right, that's one of the things I'll talk about is how to clean up accounting returns on invested capital, because there's a lot of cleaning up to do. So that product, reinvestment rate times return on capital, is my expected growth and operating income. And that, to me, is one of those central equations in valuation. Even if you don't think of it as an equation, it links the three numbers up, right? There's reinvestment, there's growth. I think of them basically as three sides to a triangle, and they're connected together. They might not be actually explicitly connected with the equation, but when you talk about one, I'm always going to bring up the other. What do I mean by that? You want to talk about growth? I'm going to be the skunk at the party. So that's nice, but what do you have to reinvest to create that growth? I know it slows you down. You got this story you're going to tell me about growth, but I want you to slow down and think about, to grow this fast, what do I have to put back into the business? So let me try this. I'm going to take two companies, and these were part of my dark side evaluation, the first edition, Cisco and Motorola. At that time, two very contrasting companies. In 1999, Cisco's reinvestment rate was 107%. I don't know if you remember this, but when I did Cisco's reinvestment, I capitalized R&D. I also included acquisitions as part of reinvestment because that's how they grew. So they're reinvesting a lot, right? But what made Cisco so impressive in 99 was the return on capital they were delivering was 34%. Lots of companies reinvest a lot, but don't reinvest very well. Lots of companies reinvest well, but can't reinvest very much. Very few companies can pull off this trick. And Cisco did for an entire decade. You're saying, what does it mean? If those numbers can be maintained, its expected growth rate is 36.39%, and Cisco was priced to deliver that growth. And therein lies a cautionary tale, because if you think about what happened to Cisco in the next decade, which of the two numbers did they maintain? They kept the reinvestment rate high. That was easy. Keep doing acquisitions. But the other number collapsed. The 34% actually became 6, 7, 8% was less than the cost of capital. And that's what devastated the company. So when you talk about maintaining these numbers, think through the process as well. Motorola, on the other hand, had a reinvestment rate of 53%, not bad. A return on capital of 12.18%, not bad. But not bad times not bad gives you not bad. So the growth rate is not bad. Sometimes you get managers who get these visions of grandeur. Motorola says, I'd like to grow 36% a year. To which your response is, pigs can't fly. I'm not suggesting Motorola is a pig, but if your return on capital is 12%, you reinvest 53%, you cannot grow. So don't make unrealistic plans unless you think about the foundations. So reinvestment rate times return on capital. Again, set those three questions. In fact, write the three equations right below each other, and you're going to see I'm doing exactly the same thing. It's the same process, just different viewpoints. Now let's get to the issue of efficiency growth. When your return on capital is changing, there's an added impact on your growth rate. So if the three equations I've shown you so far are called sustainable growth or fundamental growth equations. They're all built on the presumption that your return on equity and return on capital are stable. They're not changing over time. But if you have a company where margins are changing, returns on capital are changing, do not use the sustainable growth equation, at least for the near term, because it's going to give you the wrong answer. Because if your return on capital changes, there is going to be that efficiency effect. And the efficiency effect, mathematically, is going to be the change in your return on capital as a percentage of what your existing return on capital is. Let me give you an example. Remember that Motorola growth rate I showed you? 53% reinvestment rate, 12% return on capital, roughly 6.5% growth. There were signs in 99, when I was sitting down to value Motorola, that things were starting to improve there. That they were on the path to improving their return on capital. Let's say you buy into that story. And you assume that over time the return on capital will increase. And in this case, let's assume you expect it to increase towards 17.22%. Which at that time was exactly halfway between where they were and where the industry average was. So already you know now there's going to be some efficiency growth, right? Let's say you want to mathematically figure out what that growth is going to be. Let's do it simplistically. Their return on capital right now is about 12%, right? They're going to improve their return on capital by about 5%. 5 divided by 12, roughly speaking, is about, 40-something percent? So over the next 5 years, the collective growth from efficiency is going to be about 40%. So if you have very little time to work, you'll divide the 40 by 5 and say, roughly speaking, each year my growth rate will be 8% higher than my sustainable growth because I'm improving my return on capital. I'm going to give you a slightly more sophisticated way of doing it. It doesn't really matter that much if you don't want to go down this route. What I did was I took the return on capital of 17.22%. First, I assume all new investments, you're going to make that already. Why start at 12 and work up to 17 on new investments? So let's say that's happening in the new investments. On the old investments, here's what I'm going to do to estimate each year what this should be one-fifth. It should be raised to the power of one-fifth, not multiplied by one-fifth. So move that up there. Here's what I did. I took 1 plus the change in the growth rate. Change in the return on capital divided by so that tells me the improvement over time. And then I assume there's going to be a compounding effect. 42% over 5 years basically means it's going to be a little less than 8% a year. That's what I'm capturing here. The net effect of this is here's what I find. The new investment growth is going to be 9% a year. That's just the growth, that's just this traditional equation. But there's an extra 7.17% of growth you're going to get each year for the next 5 years. Because Motorola is improving its return on capital. over time. This is actually a huge bonus for some of you working with companies with really low returns on capital. You see why this is going to be a bigger oomph when you have a really low return on capital? Is if you start with a 3% return on capital and you improve to 6%, you get 100% growth rate. You start with a 20% return on capital, you improve to 23%, it's a much smaller impact. So companies with really low returns on capital, where you think there's potential to improve the return on capital, this is going to give you growth, at least in the short term, that will make your growth rate much higher than a sustainable growth rate. Some of you are going to plug numbers in for your company, and I'm going to estimate your existing reinvestment rate and existing return on capital. If you use my spreadsheet, you're going to look at those numbers and say, oh my God, my reinvestment rate is only 2%. My return on capital is only 7%. 2% of 7% is 0.14% growth. Before you use that, though, check your return on capital, because if you think it's going to improve over time from 7 to 12 or 7 to 15, you can still get high growth coming primarily from that improved efficiency. So now we're ready to actually start thinking about quality growth as opposed to growth. One of my pet peeves is analysts who treat growth as always good. High growth is good, bad, low growth is bad. Really? Why? So what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to take a look at these five companies I'm going to show you. And I'd like you to rank them from highest quality growth, highest value growth, to lowest value growth. So here's the first company. It has a reinvestment rate of 20%. Return on capital of 50%. Its return on capital on existing investments is 10% before and after. Its expected growth rate is only from new investments. Second company, reinvestment rate of 100%, return on capital of 10%, growth rate. So all five companies have exactly the same growth rate. But the way they get the growth is different for the five companies. Your cost of capital is 10%. Which of these companies has the most valuable growth? They all have the same growth rate, but I'm going to argue that some of these companies are actually doing nothing with that growth, some are destroying value with the growth, some are increasing value. Let's start with the easier one then. Which of these companies is destroying value while it grows? Company 3. What is it about Company 3 then? What's the trigger that leads you to believe they're destroying value? What are you comparing, Justin?
ROIC on new investments.
They're making 5% of their project, the cost of capital is 10%, they're growing, but they're actually destroying value while they grow. So let's put them at the very bottom of the list. Which of these companies is kind of running in place? They're growing, but they're doing nothing for you. Take a look at Company 2. What's it doing? It's growing, it's earning a return on capital of 10%, its cost of capital is 10%. It's a blah company. It's neither good nor bad. It's doing nothing. Okay, that's fine. They're running in place. So that's number 4. So now I've taken 2 off the list. You can take the first 3. And if you're a long-term investor, which of the other three would you like to put your money in? What are you focusing on if you're a long-term investor? Long-term sustainable growth, right? Which of these companies is creating the most long-term sustainable growth? Which one? And what is it about Company 1 that's so attractive? It's reinvesting very little. It's returning its 50%. It's giving you 10% growth, and it'll continue. This is the gift that keeps on giving. So Company 1 will be here. Company 5 actually is a very good company for next year. Do you see why? You're getting growth with investing nothing, but that's it. It's a one-year phenomenon. And Company 4 is kind of like Company 2, but at least for 1 year you will get a little bit of a bonus from efficiency. That's what I'd like you to start thinking about when you think about growth. The next company you see, you know, described as a high growth company, take the growth apart. See what kind of growth it is, because not all growth is created equal. So let me go through the rankings again. If you were ranking from 1 through 5, Company 1 will be your number 1, the highest value added company. Company 5 will be right below it because you get that pure bonus growth. Company 4 will be third on the list because you get 1 year of a little bonus growth. Company 2 will be fourth on the list, and Company 3 will be at the very bottom of the list. Okay. Now let's make things really complicated. Let's suppose you're valuing a company The margins are changing, returns are changing, everything is changing. You could even have a company losing money right now. You try the sustainable growth, it doesn't work. You try the efficiency growth, it's too messy. You got to go back to basics. Basics here in what sense? You got to start at the top and work down. Start at the top with revenues. The nice thing about revenues, at least that number can never be negative. It can be zero, but it can't be negative. So the first step in this process, you start revenues and you grow them up. Get expected revenues over time. The second step in the process is you got to forecast out what the margins will look like over time. So you have an existing starting margin, which could be a negative number. You've got to give me a target margin. You move towards that margin. Third step in the process is to make your revenue growth come through. You still need reinvestment. You need a way of tying how much you reinvest to what your revenue changes. Revenue growth, margins. No. So you're going to see three numbers show up repeatedly in the valuing of these kinds of companies. You're going to see a revenue growth number. You're going to see an operating margin number. And you're going to see a number called the sales to invested capital, which measures how much invested capital I need to bring in to kind of figure out my reinvestment. So enough with the kind of abstractions. Let me take an example. Valuation I did of Sirius. This was before, I think, they took over XM Radio. So valued Sirius. And this was in June of 2006. That's what they look like that. Revenues of $187 million. Operating income of minus $787 million. This is what happens when you have a lot of infrastructure to invest in. And your operating margin is minus 420%. Let's get the duh proposition out of the way. If I expect them to continue to lose 420% every year for not even very long, they won't be around, right? They have a lot of promise in 2006. At least in 2006, they did. So here's my first step. I'm going to start with low ambitions. I'm going to say I'm going to get the revenues first. So I projected out revenues going up. You say, how do you come up with this? How did Sirius expect to make money? Basically, subscription. Go ahead. Subscription. So basically, that's what I had to start with. I had to start with what that potential market was, what percentage. Is it going to be an estimate? Of course. Am I going to be wrong 100% of the time? Does it bother me? Not in the least. Get used to that. If you have that attitude, you can value just about anything. Because if you say, this is my fault, if I get it wrong, I'm going to kill myself or I'm going to hurt myself, don't do it. Okay? You're going to be wrong. Why? Because you're trying to forecast the future. So I'll talk a little bit more about the specifics of how to define the potential market and the market share, because we have to deal with that when we talk about valuing Uber or valuing. But that was my starting point. As I made small revenues to big revenues. See, how do you come up with these numbers for years 1 through 10? I make a confession. I made them up. The only rule I followed is as the company gets bigger, the number should get smaller, which kind of makes sense, right? It's a base number. But my end game is what's driving this. So I make a small revenue into a big revenue. I'm a third of the way there. What's the second problem I have? I'm losing a lot of money, right? I've got to make the minus into a plus. So here's what I did. I set a target operating margin. You're saying, what the heck is that? That's what I expect their margin to be once they get through these growing pains. And the way I got that was I looked at the biggest players in the business, either people collecting subscription fees or collecting advertising revenues in the business, and I used a margin of 19.57%. So that's what the margin is in 10 years. Margin right now is horrible, right? I've got to get the margin for the next 10 years, and here's something I'm going to suggest to you that I'll come back and talk about later. Do not put yourself in the position of having to try to hand estimate the margins in year 1, year 2, year 3, year 4. You are going to go crazy. In fact, what you'd like to do is have the computer fill out the middle numbers. That's exactly what I did. I set up an algorithm, and all the algorithm did was it took the starting number and the ending number, and it basically worked out the numbers. And in this case, the algorithm was very simple. See the starting number, minus 420? What's my ending number? About plus 20, right? What's the distance between those two numbers? About 440. I took half the distance to my goal. You think that's not very scientific. You want to fight me on it? I'll give it to you. You want year one's margin? Keep it. You want to do year two? Keep it as well. You give me the starting and the ending numbers. You can have all the middle numbers, and you can spend the next 16 weeks estimating them. I don't think it's going to make much of a difference to my valuation. So my margins are actually just kind of this preset path from big negative to a big positive number. My operating loss becomes an operating profit. My problem's gone away, right? My company's gone from being the small money-losing company to a nice big money-making company. Now, to complete the other side of the picture, I also looked at how much will they need to reinvest. And to do this, I use a ratio that I'm going to come back to again and again. It's been a very useful ratio for me in valuing young growth companies. It's called the sales to invested capital ratio. Saying, what the heck is that? Remember how I computed invested capital, return on capital, book value of equity plus book value of debt minus cash? I computed that for every company in the sector. I took the revenues for every company in the sector. I divided the revenues by that invested capital. I'm getting a rough measure of, in this sector, for every $1.50 in revenues, it looks like you have to invest a dollar in capital. A very simplistic tool, but it's a tool that's going to allow me to estimate reinvestment each year. So, because here's what I do. I take the change in revenue each year. So take year one. I'm going from 187 to 562. That's a $375 million change in revenue, right? If I get $1.50 in revenue for every dollar in invested capital, that must mean that I reinvested $250 million, 375 divided by 1.5. So my reinvestment in year one is $250 million. All I do is take the change in sales divided by 1.5. I get the reinvestment in that year. You say, what's in that reinvestment? Net capex, change in working capital, acquisitions, R&D. It's all there. You say, why aren't you breaking it out? How could I even start? Even Sirius could not tell me what they're going to do. So in a sense, don't try to play God by putting in too much detail. So that's my return. That's how much I'm reinvesting each year. And I keep track of two other numbers. And these are numbers that I use to check myself. Because in a sense, I've estimated revenue growth, margins, and reinvestment as separate numbers, right? I might be creating a company in my spreadsheet that is so special, nobody's ever seen a company like this before. So here's what I do to make sure that my numbers actually are in sync with each other. So remember what I described reinvestment as? It's a change in invested capital. So what I did was I took the starting invested capital, kept adding the reinvestment each year, and kept track of what the invested capital looks like over time. So basically, I take this, so by the end of year 10, I have $7.556 billion in invested capital. I take my operating income that I estimated and divide by that invested capital, I get an imputed return on capital. Imputed because it's coming. I say, what do I do with that? Then I ask myself, am I okay with this number? The case of Sirius, I could live with 15.81% because that was very similar to what the other companies have said. If I got 158.1%, what's it telling me? My spreadsheet is yelling at me. I'm not listening, right? What is it saying? You're not investing enough. Can I fix it? Sure. Sales invested capital is my number. So if I think the invested capital is too low, I go in and lower that number. My invested capital is going to go up. If my return on invested capital is 1.58%, the spreadsheet is saying you're killing this company. I'll go back and I'll raise it. Use the feedback from your own spreadsheet. This is not about my disagreeing with you. This is about you disagreeing with yourself. That's a very bad place to be. One of the things I said in the middle of the semester, your DCF comes to me. What I'm looking for is not whether your assumptions are right, because I have no idea. You know your company better than I do. All I'm going to be checking is, are your assumptions consistent with what you're telling me about the company? Are your assumptions consistent with each other? Are you creating a company that you tell me this company is going to look like because it's there in the spreadsheet, right? So take a look at your year 10 numbers and say, hey, what kind of company am I creating here? Is this a company that I think is viable? Don't ask, is it possible? It's too weak. Is it plausible? Is this the kind of company I can create? And that's the advantage of keeping track of these numbers. So if I were to pull everything together, last piece of this puzzle. Lots of different ways of estimating growth, right? Some more useful than others. First thing to remember is, think about what you're forecasting growth in. Is it revenues, operating income, net income, earnings per share? With each one, you have choices. You can go with past growth or with fundamentals, with operating income, with equity earnings. You can go with past growth, fundamentals, or analysts. And I've kind of told you where I stand with historic and analyst estimates. Make your own judgment. Then you have to decide earnings per share and net income. Trace it through. If your return on capital or return on equity is stable, then you can just take the reinvestment rate times return on capital. If it's not stable, then you have a lot more work ahead of you. Either have to assess the efficiency growth or start from scratch. Start with revenues, margins, invested capital. But don't, again, put the onus of getting this number right. This is the place in valuation where people get uncomfortable. Why? Because you have to make assumptions. You have to make estimates. It's okay to make assumptions. It's okay to make estimates. Okay? And all I can ask of you is that you use all the information, you create a narrative for the company that your numbers are consistent with, and you check to see whether your company in year 5 or 10 looks like your narrative. Okay? So don't put the weight of the world on your shoulders when it comes to growth. It's a number that drives your valuation, but it's a number that everybody has to estimate. You're not unique in feeling this uncertainty. It's natural. So we're going to end with that. So the quiz will cover everything through growth. Okay? And next session when we start, we'll start with closing up on valuation and looking at those last pieces of the puzzle.
Thank you. Yes. 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 Y